There are lots of things you can spend your tax refund on, but one thing you don't have to spend it on? A new smartphone. Switch to MetroPCS now and get not one, but two free 4G LTE smartphones for brands like Samsung and LG. Plus, you're on T-Mobile's blazing fast nationwide 4G LTE network. Hurry, switch to MetroPCS and get two free smartphones after instant rebate. One heck of a deal, only at MetroPCS. Limited time offer. Sales tax not included in phone price. Coverage and services not available everywhere. See store for details and terms and conditions.
Blog Talk Radio.
Hermetic Hour. It's Thursday, April 12, 2012. I'm your host, Polk Runyon, and tonight we'll introduce Professor Curtis Shoemaker, who teaches English literature at Cal State and specializes in the study of science fiction. Curtis is also an occultist and a Masonic scholar. He will discuss the recent book on occult writers in literature, The Dark Muse, which was recently reviewed in the third issue of this new Seventh Ray. And we'll discuss the concept of the weird as a manifestation of an incomprehensible, irrational universe, as opposed to a supernatural universe where everything follows the rules of magic, which of course seem reasonable in their own context. But we'll touch on Lovecraft's scientific magical mythology, and we'll move on to the later writers in the Lovecraft cycle, Fritz Lieber, Our Lady of the Darkness, and Richard Matheson, Charles Beaumont, Jack Williamson, that's darker than you think, and even a Jungian perspective on the Golden Dawn Crowley-type magic. So, get your notebooks ready to write down some books that you'll want to read, and pretty shortly we will have Dr. Shoemaker on, and right now, while he is, before he calls in, I can read you a little bit of this review that we wrote on The Dark Muse, A History of the Occult by Gary Lachman, and that was from the Thundermouth Press, New York, 2003. And I said, this excellent book was recommended to me by my colleague, Professor Curtis Shoemaker. Had he not suggested it, I would have passed it by as yet another history of the occult, and that would have been a mistake. The subtitle in this case was misleading. The Dark Muse, Occultists in Western Literature, would have been a better choice. And the book covers the lives and works of noted authors who were strongly influenced by the occult from the Enlightenment in the 1700s through the Romantic period in the 1800s to the 20th century. As such, it has an important place in any study of Western esoteric tradition. And I would include it, along with Richard Cavendish's The Black Arts and Jocelyn Godwin's The Theosophical Enlightenment, to round out a full picture of our often misunderstood and undervalued realm of spiritual expression. Dr. Shoemaker, are you with us?
Yes, here I am.
Oh, here you are. And I have just finished reading enough of the review on The Dark Muse, which you recommended to me and that I thoroughly enjoyed. And would you want to kick off tonight's with a little discussion on Gary Lachman's The Dark Muse?
Well, yeah, I think that was a very interesting book, of course, for all the reasons that you were just mentioning. I think it is particularly interesting in terms of what I want to get into in the 20th century, is that it shows kind of an evolution in the thinking of, let's say, what do you want to call it, esoteric theory, magical thinking, the symbolism of the unreal or the magical, whatever particular terms you like to use about it, in that up until about the 18th, 19th century, you really have magic used sort of as a tool in literature, both in poetry, fiction, and, of course, dramas like, Marlowe's Faust and so forth, where you have basically it's a toolkit. You know, somebody puts a curse on somebody, somebody makes a deal with the devil, somebody has a magic potion that does this or that. And I think as the book clearly shows, it seems to focus mostly on 18th century into the 19th century writers. You begin to get a deeper, more nuanced idea of, regardless of whether you think all of these forms of magical theory are actually real or something that are just works of the imagination, in either case, they're giving some pretty deep insights into human psychology, human archetypal thinking, and the writers began to really exploit and develop this, I think, in the 19th century when you get along with your Albert Pikes, your Frasers, and the writers associated, various thinkers, writers, magicians associated with the original Golden Dawn. W.B. Yeats, of course, being the highest expression of that period, although he would be a completely different topic, one for a complete hour in and of himself, so I don't think we'll get into him a whole lot tonight. That's kind of the way I see the projection of that book, is going to the more nuanced, the more psychological, the more what can these systems of magic tell us about the human condition and deeper insights into our own thought processes and so forth. What do you think about that analysis?
Well, I think that's right on the nose. But something I'd like to ask you while we're on the subject of the Dark Muse and what and Gary Lachman, as I said, he filled a gap in our history of occultism by concentrating on the writers of literary quality, for the most part, who were deeply into the occult and who wrote their literature on occult themes. And, of course, one of them that we recently promoted was John Patochki and the Saragossa manuscript, and that's now become literature. And of course, Guy de Maupassant. We were joking earlier. One of the things Gary Lachman does, he's very sympathetic. He's very sympathetic, but he doesn't pull any punches when it comes to the insane idiosyncrasies of these people.
What I like about them.
Oh yeah, the romantics. I mean, the romantics are they suffer and they have these grand melancholics and they suffer for Guy de Maupassant. Did he think his neti pot that he was snuffling for his sinus trouble, that he thought his brain was running out into his neti pot?
Yeah.
and then of course, but Gerard de Nerval. He's the one, of course, we've mentioned him several times. Gerard de Nerval collected the Sheba, the alternate Masonic legend from Turkey about the Queen of Sheba being one of the Grand Masters of Masonry. And so what does he do? He commits suicide by hanging himself with a garter that he claimed belonged to the Queen of Sheba. And so these people were fascinating, but they're literary. Now, one of the things I'm wondering about, though, and maybe we could kick this around a little bit, why did Gary Lachman leave out, he had Crowley in there, but why did he leave out Lovecraft? What do you think the reason for that was?
My thinking on that is that he's just taking Lovecraft's statements about his own writing at face value, and I've read enough. You know, Lovecraft wrote over 100,000 letters in his lifetime, you know, several million words in addition to his published fiction, and I own several of those volumes of collected letters. And I think Lovecraft is pretty much adamant in the sense that he's not an occultic writer at all, that he's simply using these tropes in a way to tell interesting stories. And I think on the deeper level, what Lovecraft is doing, if you look at all of these strange deities and forces that he deals with, it's actually going back to modern humans' reaction to rather scary scientific concepts, the ones that put our world kind of out on the edge of the universe, the idea of the thermodynamic principles of the universe, that the universe is leading toward an entropy, you know, the complete dissolution of all energy, which, you know, does not, of course, concord very well with our religious beliefs and is very threatening. And, you know, I mean, if you look at the, you know, the greatest horror in Lovecraft is about these dead cities where everything is winded down, and even the gods of those cities, no matter how powerful they once were, are just these corpses that will cause weird effects to happen to you, but, you know, aren't really potent in the sense of sentient beings anymore. And so I think of Lovecraft as much more of someone who's using these occultic tropes and archetypes just to kind of express a very modern and very scientific human fear, the science that reveals more about the universe than we might like to know. Now, of course, that could be considered a form of esoteric occult literature simply because of the way he projects it, and maybe you could say that all other writers are doing in the field are kind of doing the same thing. But my guess is he left Lovecraft out just because Lovecraft was so serious and so adamant about dismissing.
Yeah.
He
insisted that he was a complete materialist. Of course, I'm sure you and I have both read DeCamp's biography on Lovecraft. Well, so we know, which is in depth, which is really in depth. So we know that Lovecraft, when he was a child, he was absolutely, totally romantic when he was a child, and he adopted a persona of Abdul al-Hazred and decorated his room like an Arabian harem, you know, and called himself Abdul al-Hazred when he was a child, and so maybe he was reacting against the romanticism of his juvenile period. And he just insisted he was complete materialist. I think, you're right. That's probably why Lachman just figured that, we'll take this guy at his word.
Just another thing about his childhood that you were mentioning. I also think that immersion into this sort of romantic world that he created for himself was in part a reaction from just this terrible childhood he had, you know, the death of his father, the schizophrenic mother who would tell him that he couldn't play with the other children in the neighborhood because his appearance was too hideous. I think she told him that when he was like 6 years old. She would occasionally wake him up in the middle of the night and take him to a closet to hide because there were winged demons beating at the windows trying to get in. And so I think that deeply influenced how Lovecraft wrote, obviously, all of those themes.
Of
the outsider, you think of the music of Eric Zahn, all of those things that were happening to him through the illness of his mother are things that he writes about, but I also think he psychologically wanted to say he's in control of that, that he's not compelled to write about these things from childhood trauma, that he's just objectively using them as material for his writings, and he's not really crazy, he's not really influenced by the psychological problems of his mother, he's perfectly rational. And so I think that would also lead to the rejection of that romantic period in his childhood that you were talking about, if that makes sense as amateur psychology.
I think that's, you're probably right, and he overreacted with his materialism, but yet we know from reading biographies and his own writings and the whole spectrum of it that he was actually getting a lot of his ideas in his dreams. He was dreaming these things, and of course, I've said over and over again that the dream cycle stories, people remember Lovecraft for his Cthulhu mythos, but the dream cycle stories are really my favorites. I think
that
they're beautiful.
Unknown to Death, the Silver Key. What's the other major one? There are those two certainly. But there's some really good work he's done. Yeah, that was what they call his Dunsean period.
And I don't know how you feel about this because you're an English professor, but I think, having read all of Dunsany's material, I don't like Dunsany. I love it, but I think Lovecraft was a better stylist than Dunsany. I really do.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean he was a great stylist. I mean, you're talking of levels of qualities, very adjective heavy. Very light on dialogue, long kind of repetitive paragraphs. But you're right. He still makes him a cut above. The reason he survived, well, all of the kind of most of the cult, pulp writers of his fiction, as well as Dunsany, although I'd hate to put Dunsany in the same cult as, same category as the pulp writers. But still, yeah, I think there's something, a sense of his ability to describe the indescribable that just creeps in on you and stays with you. Whatever he's doing, whatever you might describe as technical flaws in his sentences, whatever he's doing there, he's doing something very powerful and very memorable. I remember when I first started reading him when I was 12, 13, 14, those were the only stories I couldn't finish sometimes because they were so scary. I could read Poe. I could read any of the people who were publishing more contemporaneously to my time, Matheson, people like that, Robert Bloch. That was fun reading. But Lovecraft, it was you get into those stories and you're looking for a way to get out after a couple of pages because they're so powerful. So yeah, I think you're onto something there.
It had that mad intensity. The same thing in his own way, Robert Howard had that touch of madness that lent an intensity to his work that you literally could just feel it. It came over you like some sort of almost a wave of dark emotion that these writers were able to get into their work. Along that line, one that you didn't mention, but along with Lovecraft, Dunsany, and all, Clark Ashton Smith, I think, he's having a revival now, too. And we shouldn't forget Clark Ashton Smith.
Oh, yes. They've been republishing his collections of short stories. They're very, very poetically written. In fact, one thing most people don't know about Clark Ashton Smith is he was seen as one of the up-and-coming modernist writers, modernist poets, I should say. He was considered to be someone who's going to join the company of T.S. Eliot and Ezra Pound in that group. And he ultimately kind of turned aside from working purely in his career as poetry and did more of the fantastic stuff, probably because it paid better, or paid anything at all, actually. He there's no doubt about his quality as a writer, just beginning with his work as a poet and then him transferring that to his fiction. And the big problem in American literary admiration, putting things into the literary canon, if it's something supernatural or horrific in some sense, unless it's Edgar Allan Poe or Nathaniel Hawthorne, which we'll kind of let slip in under the door, unless it's something like that, until recently, it was something that did not deserve serious consideration. I think if people had looked at Clark Ashton Smith in terms of what he was doing with his modernist poetry and then tried to see the same sensibilities and aesthetics that he was bringing to his fiction in an unbiased way, I think American literary history would be much different, that he would be included as an important writer of the 20s and 30s. So, yes, thanks for bringing him up. You slipped my mind there for a moment.
One of the reasons why I wanted to bring him up was because I have a theory, and I don't know whether you agree with it or not,
But I think that Jack Vance, especially his Dying Earth, I love Jack Vance's Dying Earth series, and they're just wonderful. But I see so much Clark Ashton Smith in Jack Vance's Dying Earth, and I wonder if you'd agree with me on that.
Well, I'm familiar with some of Jack Vance's stuff. I have to tell you the truth. He's not an author that I've read heavily, including The Dying Earth. So that's one of the big gaps, I suppose, in my reading there. But so I'll just let you comment on that.
Well, let me just say this about Dying Earth. The whole Dungeons and Dragons thing, the whole Dungeons and Dragons shtick, comes right straight out of Dying Earth, and the fellow that invented, to started off the Dungeons and Dragons tradition, he just died recently, and before he died, he frankly admitted that he owed it all to Jack Vance. And so we can say that the line for Clark Ashton Smith through Jack Vance to Dungeons and Dragons, and I have to get that in there because that's, Dungeons and Dragons has had tremendous influence on the whole idea of magic.
I would have a question for you there, and again, I'm not as familiar with Vance's publication history. I mean, how does that fit in terms of the timeline with Fritz Leiber's Fafhrd and the Grey Malcher stuff, is sword and sorcery,
did that come later? You wanted to talk about Fritz Leiber and the Grey Malcher and Fafhrd and the Grey Malcher and all that, which I love those stories. Mm-hmm. I think came along actually before the Dying Earth, and I think they may have had some influence on Vance too, but I think the first Grey Malcher stories were back right before World War II, weren't they?
Oh, yes, they were very old. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And, that's not very old. I don't know. Okay, maybe it is very old. But anyway, let's talk about Fritz Leiber and the Grey Malcher. And also, you mentioned Our Lady of Darkness in connection with Leiber, and that's one I'm not familiar with. The only ones I've read
are the Grey Malcher ones.
Yeah, I think Fritz Leiber, most people admire him for his fantasy work of the so-called sword and sorcery, which supposedly he coined that term, or it was coined to describe his writings. What interests me about Fritz Leiber is more his modernist work, where he's trying to bring these subjects into the 20th century. Our Lady of Darkness is basically set in San Francisco. I believe it said at the time the book was written in the 1960s, maybe the early 1970s, and it involves, and you'll recognize this theme very quickly from a very popular film that badly misused it and badly plagiarized it, but it concerns an architect who built buildings around San Francisco with strange geometries and out of unusual metals and substances, that he was basically turning San Francisco into this sort of powerful mystic machinery. I forget the exact term that Leiber uses in the story, but a kind of mancy that deals, archimancy or something like that. It deals with architecture, and it's very much cast in the light of the psychologies of Jung and Freud. And the talisman that the key character uses to kind of ward off the evil that the city is drawing down is basically his list of 20th century books of psychology. Well, starting with Nietzsche, I denounce you in the name of Nietzsche and Freud and Carl Jung and
I'm going to have to read this one.
And of course, the movie I mentioned is Ghostbusters, which just simply takes that idea and turns it into a joke. But the plot of Ghostbusters, most people don't know, comes directly from Our Lady of Darkness. But anyway, except in a less humorous form, obviously. Sorry to interrupt.
Let me get you to wonder whether or not it might have had some influence on that film Dark City. You remember that?
It's
a Phil Dickian. It's a Phil Dickian kind of thing. But then again, it sounds like maybe Leiber's Our Lady of Darkness had something to do with that too.
I would think so. I mean, it's a book that people kind of forget today, but it was a prominent bestseller back in the early 70s, and I think it had an effect on a lot of the writers. I think you'd see it on Stephen King's work later in the decade, you know, several other people as well. I think Clive Barker perhaps has some influence on it. So I think it's a very, you know, lesser-known book, unfortunately, but very much in the, you know, very much an influential book for the writers that came after that period. Now, if I could go back to Leiber for a moment, if you don't mind me reading a couple of quotes, I'm taking something from his short story. It's actually more of a novella. It's called A Bit of the Dark World. It's published in several books in Leiber's Heroes and Horrors anthology. I believe it's also in Ghostlight, which is the special book that was dedicated to him by the Nebula Awards Committee when they made him the first Grandmaster of Science Fiction and Fantasy. And Ghostlight was the commemorative book that was published to mark that occasion. And here in Heroes and Horrors, which is a horror story set in the Santa Monica Hills. So it's set in the, you know, very contemporary period in the middle of a city. And it begins with several characters debating whether or not you can have modern horror. And let me just read you a few things, because this puts everything I was going to say, hope to get in tonight, every theme is kind of contained in these three quotes. First of all, one character objects to the idea that you can really scare anybody more with the supernatural. We become too smart and shrewd and sophisticated to be scared by fantasies. Most especially, we got an army of experts to explain away the supernatural sort of thing. The incident starts to happen. The physics boys put matter and energy through the finest sieves. There's no room left in it for mysterious rays and influences except the ones they described and cataloged. Another character mentions, well, you don't really need the supernatural anymore. He says, today you've got Nazi death camps, brainwashing, Black Dahlia, sex murders, race riots, stuff like that, not to mention Hiroshima. Why do we even need the supernatural to scare us anymore? But then here is what the one character replies to that I think is perhaps the most poignant thing that addresses supernatural horror literature, especially in the 20th century. But I'm talking about supernatural horror, which is almost the antithesis of even the worst human violence and cruelty. Hauntings, the suspension of scientific law, the intrusion of the utterly alien, the sense of something listening at the rim of the cosmos or scratching faintly at the other side of the sky. You know, there's the idea that there's a sort of world beyond ours where logic simply does not apply, where the things that happen are not going to follow any rules, where they're going to be completely inexplicable. And the story is prefaced by a quote from Rudyard Kipling. There was a crack in his head, and a little bit of the dark world came through and pressed him to death. And so I think that's where Leiber is kind of writing at in the 20th century. We've got all of our science, all of our clear understanding of the geography of the Earth, of our physics, of our own psychology, but there's still these horrific, inexplicable, illogical things that continue to punch through and haunt us. And so that was one tradition of literature that I'd hope we could talk a little bit about tonight. And I think Fritz Leiber, especially in that story I just quoted, you know, defines it the most clearly.
Well, you know, that along that line, Doc Smith, who created the Lensman series, which is some people say that was who invented space opera? Was it Edmund Hamilton or was it Doc Smith? It's kind of a toss up, but Doc Smith developed as a course of doing his Lensman books, which the Jedi owe a lot to Doc Smith, of course, and the. He developed this idea of two universes, the evil universe, which is it's a galaxy actually, going through our galaxy at a certain period way back at the, you know, before the Earth was even created.
Right.
This evil galaxy interpenetrates our galaxy, and at this point, There is an eternal war started within the galaxy between these discordant, completely alien forces of evil, and the force of cosmic order, which of course is the
originates in our galaxy. Yeah, right.
And they have the lens, and of course through the lens, the lensmen, which are an earlier version of the Jedi, go out to do battle against these evil forces. Now, I'm not saying that Smith said all this. I think Smith came up with this later on. He didn't have it when he started it, but he kind of developed that idea. And
I don't think it's until the second or third book that they fully explain that background. Is that it's been a long time since I've read them, but it was certainly a mythology that he developed as the books went on.
Yeah, and that's kind of this idea of this utterly alien force, this utterly alien that pervades. And Lovecraft's idea was that, as I recall, that they were outside, they had been expelled from the Earth, and they were somewhere in interdimensional limbo trying to come back.
Yeah, exactly. And of course, that gives you the scientific loophole that you need these days. And I think you dealt with that a little bit in your own work, you know, Beyond Lemuria, the idea that, okay, we fully explain the surface of the Earth, its interior, the space surrounding us, but then also physicists are talking about all of these multidimensional things that, you know, don't necessarily obey our rules, and that kind of gives us a way out of the rigidity of modern physics.
Yeah, that's becoming, as I'm sure we all know that the idea of these parallel worlds and these interdimensional phenomenon are becoming more and more theoretically and physically possible, whereas back before quantum physics came to the fore, back in the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, these were considered pretty far out ideas, and now they're actually getting some credence.
There are many important scientists. I think starting with Stephen Hawking have written about the possibilities of the multiverse and how it might physically exist. And you know, most of those theories, of course, say that these other universes can't interpenetrate with our own, but then, since we don't know anything about them, who knows? And that allows an entirely interesting line of speculative and imaginative thinking. By the way, just mentioning the Lensman, of course, I hope most of our listeners recognize that the popular comic book Green Lantern was, at least in its modern conception, you know, the modern Green Lantern with Hal Jordan is very much drawn from the Lensman series.
Oh,
it's
absolutely.
It's the little ring that they wear instead of the wrist bracelet, but it does pretty much the same thing. And you have the OANs in the Green Lantern series, who are the guardians of our galaxy and are fighting against the darker forces that confront them. I mean, it's just, you know, whoever kind of developed that version of the Green Lantern mythology just put E.E. Doc Smith straight down the line and changed the name.
Well, Skorzeski, the fellow that the guiding light behind and the creative force behind Babylon 5, which I really enjoyed as a TV show, Babylon 5, that was based on Smith. Very much so. And he said so. I mean, he said this. Well, which brings me around to my favorite subject right now is that this movie John Carter, which nobody could figure out what it was about, and which, by the way, as you mentioned, this is the number one film in Russia right now. John Carter. It's going like crazy in Russia, but in the United States, the kids are staying away from it in droves.
Go ahead.
Yeah, but I was going to say, though, is John Carter, Edgar Rice Burroughs, once sued King Features over Flash Gordon. He said, Flash Gordon is a straight lift from John Carter.
And yeah, and the only reason why they didn't win the suit was because there were so many other lifts from John Carter at the time that they couldn't. But John Carter, Edgar Rice Burroughs, John Carter started off a whole genre of sword and sorcery on other planets. That's basically what it was.
Yes. And talking about John Carter, yeah, you mentioned Russia. It's actually doing quite well in virtually all the countries outside the United States. It's made more money outside than it has inside, which is almost the reverse of what usually happens. Russia in particular, especially in the it goes back to the Tsarist era, but then certainly in the early Soviet Union period, science fiction, and part of this was done as the state's decision of what kind of literature would best inspire people to move from a medieval type of setting to the that they had with the Tsars to the more modern industrial setting and the space age nation that they developed into. But science fiction became really Russia's national, or Soviet Union and Russia's national literature, and it was highly, highly respected. And I assume, I know Bradbury is one of the most popular authors in Russia. In fact, when he was premier of the Soviet Union, Gorbachev mentioned Bradbury as his favorite American author. And so over there, you've got a sense, oh, John Carter, oh, Edgar Rice Burroughs, this is literature. We've got to go see this thing, where, of course, in the United States, it's dismissed by adults pretty much as, that's some sort of kids' action and adventure fantasy fulfillment thing. And, of course, the kids are going to see it, and it's got a lot of heady intellectual concepts in it and people sitting around talking, and not so much of the nonstop action from beginning to end. And so I think in America it's suffering because of what our conceptions of science fiction should be, whether good or bad.
Yeah, well, it is. I've seen the film twice now, and John Carter was one of my favorite readings when I was a kid. I went from the Oz books, which, and of course, as we know, L. Frank Baum was a theosophist, and so there's all kinds of occult symbolism in the Oz books. And
oh, yeah.
I went from L. Frank Baum and my great love, right before puberty. And as I went into puberty, my great love was Ozma of Oz, and of course, right after puberty, my great love was Dejah Thoris. So I just really cut my teeth on those John Carter stories. And so I was really looking forward to the film, and I just found it just absolutely enchanting. I just loved it. And I've seen it twice now, I can't figure out why it's not doing better than it is. But you may be right. Maybe it's just not enough action for the kids. And who knows, but anyway, that the Edgar Rice Burroughs cycle gave rise to a whole genre of what was referred to in pulp fiction as barbarian worlds. And they were especially in a science fiction magazine called Planet Stories. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I believe so. I think I've seen those old paperbacks around, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Lee Brackett, who was Edmund Hamilton's wife, and she was a very good writer. She picked up the Burroughs Mars mantle and wrote Mars stories that had a lot of flavor and a lot of nostalgia, and owed a lot to Burroughs, of course, but still, and they were more adult. Actually, they were more of an adult feel to those stories. But she held forth in Planet Stories. That was one of her favorite venues.
Yeah, and speaking of Mars, there's two books I want to mention that I think fit in with our theme as well. The most obvious one, of course, is Bradbury's The Martian Chronicles, where he does something that is inherently magical in his conception. By the time he started writing his Martian stories in the late 40s and 50s, and certainly by the time they were compiled into a book form, I believe it was only the second or third hardcover science fiction book ever published, and if I'm thinking right, 1958, maybe a little bit later, we pretty much knew what Mars was. You know, telescopes had become advanced enough. We could tell the temperature of Mars. We could tell how thin its atmosphere was, how little water there was there, not much chance of anything more than rudimentary life, which is still in question. If there's, you know, bacteria, you know, molds, things like that there, maybe we'll find that out someday. But Bradbury had to know there couldn't be these huge cities of, you know, civilized beings living there, and he just simply chose to ignore it. He created the Mars that never was, the Mars that almost could have been, the Mars of magic, of intelligent telepathic beings, of all kinds of mysterious things. And when you get into it, it does get very, very surreal in some of those stories. You have the story where all of the writers of the occult, everyone from Edgar Allan Poe to Charles Dickens, because of A Christmas Carol, end up being exiled by the rational ghost of Earth to Mars, and, you know, are basically fighting a battle for their survival at the last place of imagination left in, you know, within the human psyche. And so I think Bradbury's Martian Chronicles definitely deserves to be mentioned alongside the ones you mentioned. And also,
Got to remember, though, Bradbury would be the first one to admit that his fascination and his romantic vision of Mars was inspired by John Carter.
No doubt about it. And he wanted to find a way to preserve that magical Mars for the 20th century in a way that the scientific exploration of the solar system would not do. And, you know, I think he succeeded very admirably in that, that we can still read the Martian Chronicles as allegory. It's basically about America's colonization of North America, and works very allegorically on that level and on many other levels as well. But you're right, it's clearly it's cities of gleaming glass structures and so forth. The sailing ships, I guess his sailing ships went across the sand as opposed to the airborne things you had in the other story. But yeah, definitely that influence is there. And also there's a book, it's called From India to Mars. It was published in, I believe, about 1903, and I'm sorry, I didn't really think about this subject coming up enough to go back and look up the author, but it's a early 20th century book. It's about a man who goes to India to practice esoteric meditation, and from that projects himself in an out-of-body state to Mars, where he encounters all of these Martian races. So very, very clearly a model for John Carter of Mars. His was much more spiritual. The guy isn't going there to you know, marry the cute Martian princess and fight against all the bad guys. It's just walk around the different cities and talk about Hindu and Buddhist philosophy and gain insight into it.
And there was also one that came out before Burroughs wrote his, called Gulliver on Mars. And this one, and as I recall, and I haven't read either of those, but I'm familiar with both of the ones you mentioned, but I haven't read them, but somebody had British gunboats floating around in the air on Mars, and really kind of Victorian steampunk kind of thing, and it was back and forth. Burroughs didn't completely invent all of this, and then somebody pointed out, and it probably goes back to that when you're discussing, that his multi-armed and multi-legged Martian animals and green people and whatever are kind of Blavatskyan. Blavatsky was talking about these the great giant blue people with multiple arms and one thing or another that used to be Lemurians or something like that. And so we got L. Frank Baum who was a theosophist, and it seems like Edgar Rice Burroughs was dipping into theosophy a bit, and also those books that you mentioned. So he wasn't all that original, but on the other hand, he put it together and made it fly better than the rest of them did.
Definitely. Yeah. And of course, all these writers are going to have their earlier influences, you know, so it's rare to see a totally unique writer. Lovecraft maybe came close with this sort of scientific, mystical pantheon, you know, the Cthulhu mythos, but I'm sure you look back far enough, you can find other people who were, you know, kind of predecessing him a little bit on that. And by the way, this is just slightly off topic, but I mentioned From India to Mars, and in this era of dying bookstores and sources, I just have to mention where I found that. It's the most amazing thing for those people who may be listening in the Midwest, especially Texas, Oklahoma, New Mexico. There's a little town called Archer, Texas. That's where the author Gertrude McMurtry's from. I'm trying to, you know, the writer of The Last Picture
the
Show.
Not
that Gertrude.
Grady. This is the other one.
I'm getting his name a little bit wrong for some reason, but the writer of The Last Picture Show, like that. Archer, Texas is his hometown, and he's turned the entire central town square into one enormous bookstore. I mean, just building after building is just filled with books, and it's very well referenced in terms of science fiction, both in first edition, hard-to-find hardcovers, as well as every Ace double-sided paperback that's ever been published, and also very, very rich in, you know, you should be surprised for a small town in East Texas, but very well-versed in esoteric and occult type books. I mean, when I went there, I found all these stuff. I was on with our Masonic Lodge's librarian, Mara Kamer, saying, I got all this stuff in front of me. There's this Rosicrucian book. Here's this Man of the Third Degree, a very well-known Masonic novel. I'm going to buy as many, you know, which of these should I buy? I don't have all the money in the world. And I was just on the phone with him. I probably picked out 5, 6, 7 books and left 20 or 30 that I couldn't bring back on the plane. So anyway, I just had, you know, in this era where books, real books, are getting hard to find, I just had to throw that pitch in there. Yeah, Archer, Texas, just outside of Wichita Falls, Texas. But anyway, let's move on with our.
Now, one thing I don't want to pass over. We mentioned in the abstract here, and based upon your outline you sent me, we were going to talk about Matheson, Charles Beaumont, and of course Jack Williamson. And I stuck in darker than you think when you got to talk.
Oh yeah,
about.
Of course.
And that was Jack Parsons' favorite novel. And then we were saying that we were going to talk about the Jungian perspective on Golden Dawn and Crowley-type magic. And
how much time do we have left?
Yeah. What would you like to talk about in the time we have left here?
Okay, we'll try to get to as many of those as we can. Maybe I can make some brief statements. But, yeah, for those who don't know, Richard Matheson and Charles Beaumont, along with Rod Serling, were the principal writers of the original Twilight Zone series. Of course, they were mostly short story writers and in Matheson's case, also novelists, before that. But that became, you know, what they're most well known for. Beaumont also wrote several of the early American international horror films, especially the ones dealing with Edgar Allan Poe's stories, The Red Death, The Raven, a couple of others.
That Roger Corman lovingly produced on a shoestring budget.
Exactly. It forced Beaumont to conform to all of his radical standards of low-budget filmmaking, like every 14 minutes, not every 12 minutes or 16 minutes, but every 14 minutes there has to be nudity or suggested nudity. He had these weird formulas that they had to follow because he thought that's why people would go see them. But Beaumont especially, and Matheson, wrote very deeply of this kind of Fritz Leiber style magical thinking, the idea of the utterly irrational just thrown right in your path in the modern world where there's no way to avoid it, no way to work your way out of it, basically unsolvable mysteries and challenges that just completely transcend human logic and understanding. So they're, you know, very, very good authors to write, to look at. And I think in the terms of Charles Beaumont, a very, very tragic figure, had an onset of early onset Alzheimer's, I think, when he was about 40, maybe even a little bit younger, and just without understanding it, because people didn't know what they were, you know, talking about back then when it came to mental illnesses, without understanding what was happening to him, just very slowly lost his ability to think clearly, and then ultimately his ability to write, and even just to see movies and follow, you know, from scene to scene what was going on. But if you look at his stories, they're about people who are undergoing these psychological traumas and mental disintegrations that are completely beyond their capacity to understand. And so I think he's taking, again, a kind of a real-life illness and putting it in that, you know, supernatural expression. But he's an incredible writer. It was actually just about 20 years ago, there's a Bill Pullman story that was made, a movie with Bill Pullman as the actor in it, I should say. Oh, no, why is that? Now that title's about to run out of my mind. But anyway, his screenplays have been produced as recently as around 1990 or so. It was Brain Something. I'll have to come back to you with that on the title, or maybe we can post it online. Wonderful movie, but it just totally slips my mind for a moment. But anyway, so those writers. Yeah, I was also mentioning the Jungian thing. I think that's where, especially in the writers that are dealing more with esoteric theory than with literature, you see these concepts of Jung and the archetypes of the unconscious slip in more and more in theory and practice. And I would say some of the most esoteric literature written, this would be, I know he's not your favorite guy, but Aleister Crowley's Elysian Rites, you know, with each of the classical planets, Luna, Sol, Mercury,
Crowley.
Venus, Mars, and so forth.
I love Crowley. I absolutely adore Crowley. I think Crowley, and I think Crowley's marvelously talented and wonderful, and I just find Crowley delightful. But I'm not going to go out and swear allegiance to Crowley.
Right. Okay. Sorry, I didn't mean to put too many words in your mouth. We've had this discussion before this concept of thelema and so forth. But anyway, back to his rights, and I got to know a couple of these much more deeply than I do with most literature, because in Minnesota, I actually had a role where I performed in The Rite of Mars as Mars. And then out here in L.A., I think you remember this a few years ago, along myself, I co-produced and co-directed and acted in, along with our friend Isabella Karina Shahira, The Rite of Venus. She was
The Darrow Princess in more ways than one.
Exactly. I think that was a performance you weren't able to attend for some reason or another, but you were familiar with what was going on. That was a very interesting time. But at any rate, in getting into these scripts in a lot of detail, I was struck by the way that it's trying to appeal to so many of the senses. You set up these sets, these temple-like sets in a certain arrangement where each one has its own quality, its own color, its own angelic its own angelic assignment. You have the music, what appeals to the mind. You have to the ear. You have the various incenses that are burned to give different types of fragrances and different types of effects on the psyche. And what you're doing in these things, as best I can understand it, after being so deeply inside them, is you're creating this deep mental space that is pulling on those, you know, Jungian concepts of the collective unconscious and the archetypes, and you're basically creating this mystical symbolic space in which you inhabit for a while, and that becomes sort of the true magic, is you've taken the ordinary world and you've transposed on top of it just by your appeals directly to the psyche. This much, much deeper unconscious symbolism. And I think Crowley himself, I mean, he waffled on a lot of his concepts here and there, but, you know, Crowley himself, I think, especially when he's talking about one of the LRPG, the vanishing ritual, he says, now remember, you know, these angelic deities and so forth that you're calling out to don't actually exist. They're only symbolic manifestations of your inner psyche. Now, he said other things to contradict that, but that at least implies that he was, pretty much along that line of thinking, that just simply accessing our deep psychology and the way that our psyche relates to the world, that in itself is a powerful form of ritual, ceremonial magic, anything that really happens in the paranormal. Yeah.
That's certainly true. How much of that is Jungian Crowley did mention in one point that he had read Jung and that Jung had some influence on him in one of his papers that he wrote. But I think personally that Crowley was much more influenced by Fraser.
I would agree with that. And that's the one problem I have with Crowley, is that in both that line of thinking and also in his poetry, he's kind of locked in this more 19th century way of thinking, you know, that represents Fraser and the forms of the Romantic poets, and he's presenting himself as the initiator of the new aeon, you know, the new world that's replacing the old. I thought that would have been more convincing, and there's certain people I know who are probably going to hear about me making these comments. But I mean, if he certainly just fully embraced modernism in all its aspects, you know, the Jungian psychology, the more modern forms and theories of poetry, but he would have been a much, much more noted figure to a wide audience than what he is today, which is someone who appeals to a very narrow audience. But anyway, that's just my thinking.
I'm pleased to hear that you agree with me on the Fraser influence. He wrote Golden Twigs, a little book called Golden Twigs, and it was really showed his love of Fraser and the Golden Bough and how much he had derived from it. And for those of our listeners who are not too familiar with Fraser, you don't have to wade through 12 volumes of the Golden Bough. There is a new edited, Ginsberg, I believe, did the editing to bring it up to date and correct some of Fraser's errors. A new Golden Bough, and it's one that everybody ought to have, along with Davidson.
That's the kind of compact one, the one that's in one volume, and it's kind of down.
It's called the new Golden Bough, you really need to get that one, because Fraser did make some errors. He did make some errors, which Ginsberg has lovingly corrected. And so that's the one you need, and it's very, very detailed. And you get that, and then you get Davidson, and those are two essential reference books for the magician. Before we get out of here, Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think, which, by the way, I'm not sure whether you're aware of this or not, but did you ever remember a movie called Angel Heart?
Oh, yes. Mickey Rourke, directed by Alan Parker.
Well, that's based on Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think. It is. It's because Jack Williamson's Darker Than You Think was Jack Parsons' favorite science fiction novel.
That's an interesting. If we had more time to explore, get into that connection of Jack Parsons, who you talked about a few weeks ago, and one of the founders of JPL and a very noted American ceremonial magician, and his connection with Jack Williamson and a few of these other early science fiction writers, including in a very negative way Ron L. Hubbard. but I guess that's a
Hubbard
discussion for another day.
Yeah, Hubbard did one similar called Fear. Now, Hubbard wrote a novel similar to Williamson's Darker Than You Think called Fear. Now, the gimmick in both these stories is that the protagonist is the villain and doesn't know it, and he's trying to catch himself.
Yeah.
He's acting as a detective, and he's trying to catch the murderer, and the murderer then turns out in the end to be himself. That's the gimmick. And both Hubbard did this one called Fear, and Williamson, which is Williamson's is better, I think, as Darker Than You Think. And both of these are both worth reading, but I think Williamson's is the superior one. I think we're going to wrap it up. We're about out of time.
It would have been nice to get into those other writers, Alamore and Neil Gaiman, but perhaps we can come back some other time. That would be a complete discussion
in itself,
that would kind of continue this. But
we'll have you back because this is a fascinating subject. It certainly relates to hermetic magic. And thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Shoemaker, and I'll be seeing you soon in some of our activities that we share. Meanwhile, be well and good magic.
I will. Yeah, I will. I'll probably give you a call in a couple of days. But thanks for having me on your program.
Okay.
I greatly enjoyed it, and have a good night.
And that was really good. Okay, thanks a lot. Next week.
93.
Yeah, 90. Okay. Next week, and this goes right along with what Curtis just said. Next week, we're going to deal with a subject that, I'm not exactly looking forward to it, but we have to deal with it, and I know you're all going to be interested. And so we're going to do it. We're going to tackle it head on next week. Magic and politics.
Ah, okay.
Yes, next week, magic and politics. And we're not going to pull any punches on this one. But this is one that everybody ought to listen to. And this is one that we're going to deal with some issues that need to be dealt with. So magic and politics next week. Meanwhile, have a good one and good magic.
Okay, thank you. Goodbye.
There are lots of things you can spend your tax refund on, but one thing you don't have to spend it on? A new smartphone. Switch to MetroPCS now and get not one, but two free 4G LTE smartphones for brands like Samsung and LG. Plus, you're on T-Mobile's blazing fast nationwide 4G LTE network. Hurry, switch to MetroPCS and get two free smartphones after instant rebate. One heck of a deal, only at MetroPCS. Limited time offer. Sales tax not included in phone price. Coverage and services not available everywhere. See store for details and terms and conditions.